you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Cynical Podcast, coming to you today from one of my favorite cities in the world, Chengdu in Sichuan Province. Let's hear you folks make a little noise. Yeah. All right. The Cynical Podcast is produced in partnership with SUP China, which is the best way to stay on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day. We are just days away from a radically new website design, which we think you're all going to love. We offer uncensored reporting and commentary on everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from Xinjiang to the South China Sea. We are sure you'll agree it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm here at a conference put on here in Chengdu by our friends and partners, Caixin, China's leading authority on business and finance. It's called Talking China's Economy, 2019 Forecasts and Strategies, and my good friend Li Xin, who is Managing Director of Caixin Global and Vice President of Caixin Media, has invited me here to do a live show. Our topic today is on Chinese investment in regions besides the United States. We all have heard an awful lot in the last couple of years about surging Chinese investment in the U.S. from, you know, some of the larger private sector firms in China. Think of the gray rhinos like HNA and Anbang. I think that many people are aware that for a whole host of reasons originating both in Beijing and in Washington, there's been a substantial decline, though, in very recently, since 2016, really, in investment in the U.S. So today we're going to look at how the horizons have really broadened for Chinese investors, what caused this broadening, and where investors are now putting their money, both in terms of geographies and in terms of sectors. With me here to discuss this topic in its myriad dimensions are two terrific guests. First up, we have Professor He Fan, who is professor at the Antai College of Economics and Management at Shanghai Jiao Tong University and Chief Economist of Entropy Capital. Professor He, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you.
We're also joined by an old friend of mine, Michael Ante, CEO of Caixin Globus, otherwise known as Zhao Jing. I don't think anyone calls you that. It's Michael Ante. So we have Antai and Ante both represented here. It'll be So when I met Michael 15 years ago or so, he was reporting for the New York Times, getting into all sorts of mischief. We're going to do another show with him at some point talking about how his views on a lot of things related to technology and censorship, things
good
like
idea.
That, have changed. But for now, we're focusing on what he's doing now, which, you know, he's doing great work with Caixin, tracking China's economic activity all around the world in over 90 cities as CEO of Caixin Globus. Michael, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you.
Michael, let's start with you, and let's try to maybe frame this issue first more broadly in terms, not just in terms of just the vicissitudes of regulation and current trade tensions between the U.S. and China. You've suggested that from China's perspective, globalization used to mean really not much more than Americanization, the nation that really loomed the largest in Chinese thinking about the world beyond China's borders was, of course, the United States. I was thinking about this and how you know, much of the time that I lived in China, it was really the case that when you said "wai yu," you meant English. When you said, like, "well, that guo wai du shu," that meant I'm going to study in America. And like when you said a "wai guo ren," or as we now call now "wai guo er," you think immediately of an American for some reason.
Yeah, I think from very small the story to tell you how important the people in China thought the Sino-American relationship is the so important relationship of the foreign diplomacy. It's from, I think it's starting from the 1990s, right? Last year, I was in the middle school, I think. And suddenly, our English book is the same, was the same, but the pronunciation changed from British English to American English. So that's the reason when I speak English, I'm a mixture with the Chinese English, British English, and American English. And because that that was the year in the 1990s. All the Chinese elite think, if we want to modernize the China, there's only one example and one teacher in the whole world. So the best thing, whatever the conservative in China said, the best way for China is follow the United States. And also in the 1990s, the end of the 1990s, Professor Shi Yinghong had a very good word to frame that. He said we should bandwagon the United States. It's just like bandwagon that. So everything Americans do, we do that. So we can. So it's the coupling stages of the China and the U.S.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this idea of Shi Yinghong. So who is Shi Yinghong? He is the director of the American Studies program at Renmin Daxue, and he's one of the most famous Chinese American watchers. And when he talked about bandwagoning, he was really talking about sort of, you know, getting with the United States, getting behind the United States in a lot of the things in the WTO. But he's moved away from that, right?
Yeah, he's recently changed his idea because you cannot, if you, it's a long far away from the number two. Okay, you can bandwagon and Americans accept you. But now you are not only number two, you are the number two has the capacity to move to number one. So all someone's think, right? So that will make the bandwagon like a very bad scenario. I think Americans starting to say, no, I don't want you bandwagon me.
This is sort of an economic version of the move away from Tao Guang Yang Hui, right? The old hide and bide maxim of Deng
Xiaoping. The point is not even you don't want to hide. If you want to still want to hide, but there is no way to hide. The GDP numbers and also the tech in sectors, private sectors, every numbers to show you're already number two in the many, many figures. So you still want to say, I'm a developed country, a developing country. I think nobody even think about that. So that's the way China still want to bandwagon, but now it's the U.S. say, no, I don't want you bandwagon.
We don't want you on our bandwagon. Yeah. So, okay, not exactly their own choice then. I'm curious, though, Dr. Hufa, are there numbers to support this idea that investment is declining in the United States and that it is increasing in other geographies around the world? And do you have some sort of back-of-the-envelope numbers that you might be able to give us?
Actually, I think they're still more or less the same. We have talked about the declining of American investment in China, but that happened a long time ago. So Americans' investment in China has reached its peak in year 2000 and 2002. So right after China joined the WTO. And then after that, you can see Americans' investment in China gradually decline. In year 2006, it dropped to somewhere between $2 billion to $3 billion U.S. dollar, and then remained stable. So approximately, American investment accounts for 2% of China's FDI. But then at the same time, we saw a rapid increase of China's investment in the United States, especially after the global financial crisis. So recently, the number, I think in 2017, if my memory is correct, is above $6 billion U.S. dollar.
Right.
And accounts for 4% of China's outbound FDI. And I haven't seen even we're talking about, you know, China is investing in other part of the world, the Road and the Belt countries, but I haven't seen a dramatic decline of China's investment in the United States. And if you look at the number, actually, I think we tend to overestimate the importance of bilateral investment. Because the link of these two largest economy is mainly through trade,
right,
and also production network and supply chain, which embodied in international trade. So trade is more important than investment.
Okay, but today we are focusing on investment. So maybe we can go back and look at that year 2016, which was sort of a heyday, though in a lot of ways very perverse, for the sort of high water mark of Chinese investment in the United States, where we saw companies like I said, HNA, Anbang, Fosun, and of course Wanda, mm-hmm. investing very, very heavily, making a lot of M&A deals in the United States that seemed to be all over the map. There was no apparent logic to them. What was going on? I think a lot of people were talking about this mainly in terms of just wanting to move assets out of China. Is that the best way to understand this?
That's part of the reason. So if you have a breakdown of China's investment in the United States, and then you see the largest component is real estate.
Real asset, real estate.
Yeah, and then followed by financial institutions, and then transportation equipment. So it's not like some media has told us that China is buying high tech in the United States. So it's mainly Chinese people is more interested in buying house in the United States. well, you can say some of the outbound investment at that time is they try to, especially some private company, they try to move their money abroad. And then recently, the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, which is
SAFE,
SAFE, which is responsible for capital control, and they have more and more strict policy. So I think that has been reduced quite a lot, this trend.
Was it also just because of the, I mean, there were a lot of people who pointed to the behavior of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And they were calling them gray rhinos, that they were sort of an obvious massive risk, a very big threat, that mm-hmm. they were highly leveraged. They were making these purchases that were not particularly economically sound. And that the reason wasn't so much, the crackdown wasn't because of this fear of capital flight,
mm-hmm.
but because of the irresponsible behavior of these companies.
Two reasons. One is because, you know, for SAFE, they really are concerned about the capital flight because well, especially
that's their purview, right? That's
what yeah, and especially, you know, after in the year 2015, we in August 11th, 2015, we have a reform of RMB exchange rate.
Right.
So the purpose is to further liberalize RMB exchange rate. But then they are doing the right thing, but then they choose wrong timing. So in the first half of 2015, there is a stock market crash. And then, you know, there is panic in the market. So people, investors tend to think every news is bad news. So after this reform, there is a very rampant capital flight. So that's the reason why SAFE tightened the capital control. And also there's another government agency who is responsible for Chinese companies' outbound investment, especially state-owned enterprises. And they learn from their experience that because lack of experience, a lot of Chinese company, and when they investing in the outside in the overseas market, and they are losing money, so they are also becoming more and more conservative since then.
So between SAFE and SASAC, there was
yeah.
There was another factor though that was on the Washington side,
mm-hmm.
and that was that beginning really in 2017, mm-hmm. we started to see much stricter CFIUS rules mm-hmm. being applied, much more scrutiny,
yeah.
and this may not have hit companies like Anbang or mm-hmm. whatever, but it did. It certainly did affect some of the technology companies and especially the energy companies.
Yeah.
So a couple of the high profile ones, of course, were the effort by Alibaba's company.
Yeah.
To acquire Western Union
mm-hmm.
for you know remittances basically,
yeah,
and the other of course was a couple actually of pretty high profile LNG acquisitions that were attempted by Chinese energy interests.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, maybe you can talk about what was driving that as well.
Our team is monitoring every day the Chinese investment cases overseas, but we. Recently, one and a half year, we recorded many, many denials from the States and from other, Australia or other Anglo-Saxon countries, right?
Right.
So, actually, Chinese companies has the two challenges to put the investment on OC. First is the government. Government didn't want your RMB investment to go out, so you cannot do that. otherwise, or you have the permission of the government. But in terms of many, many, the Chinese internet company, they have the US dollar funds.
Right.
So that's the reason after Anbang, you see the major stage gave to the internet company, because they have the US dollar in Hong Kong. Not all in Silicon Valley, not necessarily in Beijing. So that kind of money is not really controlled by Chinese government. Right. So they can invest whatever they want. But then they fear, they are meeting the second challenge, is the American government. We call CFIUS, right? CFIUS now almost blocking, I would say, 90% of the Chinese tech investment in the United States. Sometimes even gay app, right? The gay dating app.
Right, Grindr.
Grindr, right? So apparently. Why Grindr is a threat to the American nation?
Well, I can actually offer a couple of reasons. I mean, wouldn't you think that that would be a very, very easy way to be able to blackmail people? I mean, if you had...
But actually...
I mean, actually does make some sense to me.
Yeah, maybe. We see the kind of the blocking to the tech company. They have a U.S. dollar investment overseas. But still, they can't put the money to buy the, especially American assets. So then they starting to trend to other countries, for example, Europe or Japan.
Yeah, so we've been talking mainly about the reasons why maybe investment in the United States isn't looking so promising these days. So let's shift and now talk a little bit more about where people are going instead. And you know, we're hearing all this talk about decoupling when it comes to the United States, steering away from the United States and toward other directions. Michael, we were talking earlier, and you said that you see emigration trends out of China as a proxy, really, for where the money is going to be going, perhaps. Can you talk about that a little bit? Where are people now moving, if not to the United States anymore? And maybe, Khofan, you can also talk about what you've observed about that.
The Chinese people is a very strange nation that not individually invest like a pioneer to invest in one place. They like people together, right? So, for example, if your fellow villager, you know, have an investment in like Africa, Kenya, when you settle down, you ask your friend in your countryside, like, come back to that together with you. Because that kind of thing, because China is very, very newcomer about globalization. Yeah. Britain, United States, and France have already like 100 years experience how to deal with the globalization. They have a lot of the facility to make it through. For example, law, right? Rule of law system. And you have very good lawyer and a tax and even the securities firm. But also, like, you will handle the PR and also the environment issues, political issues. But China is really newcomer. They only trust their fellow guys, fellow Chinese. So, like, that's the reason we have, like, all the EU people go to one country in Africa, then all the villagers go to that country. So, like, even become, like, a king of that small country, a small tribe. So that's to show the different pattern of Chinese. So if we see the change of Chinese immigration, you can predict the investment going. I think because the decoupling of the United States, now immigrate to the United States is almost mission impossible. Like EB-5 is like 10 years
because,
waiting.
Yeah, EB-5 visas now, right?
It's like 10 years waiting.
Yeah. All right. Which is bad news for the Kushner family and their business. Right?
So I think we see the trend, they move mostly likely to the southern Europe, like Greece.
Southern Europe?
Yeah, like Greece, Spain. And also because that Europe part of Europe is open up to Chinese investment. But they starting from buy houses. This is a very funny thing. You're starting buy houses. Then you send kids there. You want to improve your kids' life, you have investment there. So that's the Chinese community we're surviving and growing in that society. That's the trend. But we do see the trend. That's the one thing, is the Southern Europe. Second thing, I think, is Japan.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of
people buy houses in Japan.
Wow, that's fascinating. Are you seeing similar trends?
Well, two comments. One comment on this immigration. I think we can find this link between immigration and investment, but then it will be very difficult to use this as a proxy to predict that where Chinese money will go, because Chinese people are everywhere. I have traveled more than 50 countries. There's only one country I cannot find many Chinese people there. It's Cuba. Because it's planned economy and
we've had enough of socialism.
Planned economy and the Chinese people are not allowed to do business there.
Oh, interesting.
And then in Africa and in Middle East and in Central Asia, everywhere, the very backwater area, and you can see Chinese people are doing business there. So this is my first comment. And the second comment, I have to disagree with people are talking about the decoupling of China and the United States. And for me, it's very difficult to imagine the decoupling of the two largest economy in the world. We heard about trade war and the trade negotiation. But to be frank, I think people in Washington, D.C. and Beijing tended to overestimate their influence. And people in Chengdu are much better. So if you look at the trade volume, United States is still the largest partner with China. So before 2006, before the global financial crisis, America is always the largest market for China's export. And then after the global financial crisis, because of the recession in United States, and then Europe become the largest trade partner. But then after 2015, with the recovery of American economy, and we saw that United States has coming back and dominate China's export and becoming the number one destination for China's export again. So, and this I think is all determined by all the economic fundamentals. If Americans' economic growth is stronger, and then the American people will buy more, and then they will buy more Chinese products. That's simple. The rising tide will raise all the boats. So that's just what happened.
Yeah, I think we're talking about two things here. We're talking about the actual possibility of genuine decoupling, which I agree with you is actually remote and not terribly plausible. The other, though, is the perception of an intention to decouple and a hostility that it generates, which is, you know, which will scare away money. And we are seeing that coming out of D.C. It's interesting, though. I would agree with you that it is not as widespread as one thinks. You hear an awful lot of it in the Beltway.
I have to add that economic is more important than political factors. I'm not saying that China will have the trade surplus forever. And down the track, we'll see a dramatic change. And probably in the future, China's current account surplus will disappear. But that's because of economic fundamentals, because saving rate in China is now declining and consumption is increasing. And I think that's the most important thing for global economy. Because imagine in the past that China is a main supplier of capital in the international market. And in the future, imagine China, a large country, started to borrow money from other country in the international market.
Not impossible.
What would be the impact for the global market? So that's what we should really watch very carefully.
When I started, I was talking about how decoupling, though, the perception of it is very real. And in one area, I think it's pretty clear, the U.S. has been pressuring a lot of other countries to resist allowing the Chinese telecom giant Huawei to either build core networks in those countries, or even to just sort of participate in its telecoms markets. It's been trying to corral the so-called like-minded countries, not just the Five Eyes, the English-speaking countries, you know, New Zealand and Australia, Canada, the United States, and so forth, but really to you know, get all of the West on board, to get behind American export controls on other aspects of our technology policies. Michael, you and I, we talked about the possibility that there might be a kind of, we might have a kind of Huawei index where we look at a country's receptivity to Huawei and its participation in its market and that country's attractiveness to Chinese emigration and to Chinese investment. Have you thought more about this in the time since we spoke a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, I think that I'm not a Huawei lover. I'm a Xiaomi fan. So to make clear, very clear. But you can see very clear things. The Western government, they have a different ideas about how to handle Huawei, especially Europe. Europe think it should be case by case. If some bad thing happened, we will rule, but we cannot to pre-attack this kind of thing. So they have different policy, but we also can see when the Chinese investment tend to invest, they also think about what Huawei's acceptance in that country. If Huawei cannot accept in that country, it's also that government also will have a lot of give them the challenge to the Chinese tech company, because now, I mentioned, Chinese only can use US dollar without the Chinese government in your control to invest overseas. That's the convenient thing. But the major challenge to this kind of investment to the overseas is that country's government, it's not Chinese government.
So it's interesting. Yeah, I think that would be a really good thing for a graduate student to undertake a study of. Maybe, Hovan, you have some student who's looking for a good dissertation topic, and he could look at the correlation between Huawei receptivity.
Well, that's a good topic. I interviewed Huawei last month, and they are quite confused. And they spend quite a lot of time explaining to foreigners that Huawei is not a state-owned enterprise. And then they are confused because they have difficulty to convince people. They said that they have tried their best. They released quite a lot of material, even their financial record, but it doesn't help. So it shows that the people will not believe what they see. People will believe what they believe.
Right.
And I think I talked with many of my foreign friends. I think ownership doesn't matter. So whether it's a state-owned enterprises or private company doesn't matter. So what matters is market structure. Because if it's a if it's a competitive market, for example, if it's a state-owned enterprises producing color TV, and there's nothing you should concern about. This state-owned enterprises, the behavior of this state-owned enterprises will be exactly the same as a private company. Otherwise,
right.
It cannot survive. But if it's a monopolistic market, whether it's a state-owned enterprises or a private company, it should be a concern because it probably will be a main barrier for fair competition. So market structure is more important than ownership.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, the other thing is it might be a privately owned company. It might be an employee-owned company, as people suggest. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that it has had access to boundless credit lines,
mm-hmm.
basically from the China Development Bank and from the Exim Bank.
The new phenomenon in China is you have difficulty to find a pure state-owned enterprises or a pure private
right.
company. It's a sort of mixed economy. So that's a new phenomenon. We still it will take some time for us to understand what it implies.
Staying with you, Hovan. So speaking of state-owned versus private sector enterprises,
mm-hmm.
who is doing the overseas investment in these areas outside of the United States? Are we seeing that it's Chinese sovereign funds or state SOEs, or is it big private technology companies along the lines of Tencent and Alibaba?
Well, regarding China's investment in the United States, definitely is safe as the central bank because we have accumulated a huge amount of foreign exchange reserve.
That's right.
And they are using the money to buy T-bills. But then in other foreign markets, for example, like in Africa and Southeast Asia, my understanding is private company discovered those new market first and then followed by some of the state-owned enterprises. So private company, like businessmen in Wenzhou and Yiwu, they always move faster than state-owned enterprises. They are the pioneers.
The Wenzhou Index.
The Wenzhou Index, yeah, and Huawei Index.
Yeah. Michael, give us some examples of some of the overseas investments that are being pursued right now in countries outside of the United States. Again, we keep coming back to America. Let's try to stay away from it for a little.
Yeah, I think you outside the United States, you can see many you know different kind of investment in that. For example, Tencent, or you can see another of the investment in the like. In the game, right?
Sure.
In the Europe game, and also no Europe because of the new
privacy
data
laws, right?
So I think it's not. But in the Middle East, right? So you can see the investment in the Middle East, but also like in Alibaba, the investment in Africa.
Right.
Jack Ma has a very big the performance in Africa, in Kenya.
Yeah.
But also they try very much to let Alipay to dominate the South Asia market. So this really one.
South Asia or Southeast Asia?
Southeast ASEAN countries.
Yeah, ASEAN countries. Right, that's right.
So and also you can see the you know Shandong Ruyi the clothing factory. They buy many Italian and the French the branding.
Huh.
Yeah. So you can see many things. Not really regular. You can see in the you know in recent report in previous report, China is try very much to pursue like the balanced you know globalization. Because if we say globalization before is only the China U.S. relationship,
right?
But now the globalization for China after this kind of decoupling, all the trend of decoupling, China now starting to pursue the real globalization. Balanced globalization. We cannot say it's the non-American globalization. I say balanced globalization.
Sure. I mean, I think that when a lot of people think about Chinese investment outside of the United States, they'll think immediately of the Belt and Road Initiative because of the hype. I think that people imagine that there has been investment activity commensurate with that level of hype. But when I look at the data, when I've looked at the data so far, it does not appear to be the case. It doesn't look like there's actually a lot of money going into Belt and Road projects. That they may be spending more money on big fora, like the second Belt and Road Forum, which is about to start in Beijing. So can you talk about that? If these Belt and Road investments aren't as substantial as we imagine, why not? Where are the big investments within the Belt and Road? What should we be? How should we understand this?
I think
maybe Hefan first.
Yeah, Hefan.
Okay, if you compare what President Xi Jinping said 5 years ago and what he said at this year's forum, and you see the difference because this road and belt policy keeps evolving. At the early stage, some people are talking about because we have overcapacity, so we'll move some of the capacity to other developing countries. And now they figure out that it's more complicated. It depends on whether you have all the supporting system to absorb your capacity. So I think now China has a more shrewd view on how to invest in the road and belt countries. And this, we learn this experience by paying a huge cost. So now they are emphasize more on not only the investment in the infrastructure, but also how to cooperate with other country and also international organization. And then, because road and belt policy is still there, it's in the constitution of the party, so we cannot change the policy. But then there is the adjustment of this policy. So I think a good example is AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Yeah. This is not directly linked with road and belt initiative. But then if you look at the way that China is working with AIIB, China is trying its best to make AIIB as an international organization. So
very
it doesn't
high standards,
it doesn't matter that AIIB will invest massively, but what it matters is it will showcase that China can also help to to establish a new international institution.
Well, it can't invest massively. It just simply doesn't have that much under management right now. And where have its actual investments gone? Into a non-Belt and Road country, actually. It's all gone into India, which is
very interesting. Yeah, it's mostly to India.
Michael, you wanted to add something?
Yeah. I think that in terms of the private sector, the local companies, we want to they think about the Belt and Road, and the investment overseas, they have the calculation. First, they want to have money. So they want to own money. So they want to find investment overseas which can get money. And also that kind of country have the market and the rule of law. You can get the money back, right? You cannot invest in North Korea, right? But also, you also need the local government to give you permission to send the money or people outside. So you should match the Belt and Road rule. So that's the reason, even you see the data, Chinese investment more to the sometime tradition, countries, not really Belt and Road country, but still Chinese companies really want to apply the Belt and Road as a kind of excuse to invest overseas, because that's very legal for them, invest overseas, given the condition of the capital control.
So as China scours the world for good investment opportunities, it's naturally going to face certain rivalries with countries that have traditionally regarded particular geographies as their own backyards. You have France, for example, in Africa. You have Germany in Eastern Europe. It's been a very, very big investor, especially since 1991. In Eastern Europe. And of course, you have Russia and to an extent Korea and Japan in Central Asia. How is China faring in investment in these areas as a newcomer, as somebody who maybe isn't as familiar with the rules of the road, with local habits and customs? How is China faring, and do you find that it's learning quickly?
Well, I think for those countries, and it will be a good news to have China as a newcomer. Because then they can, use China to negotiate with other countries. And then for China, a Chinese investor, I think the learning curve is very steep.
Yes.
And one advantage Chinese investor has is we have a better understanding of what a developing country looks like. Mm-hmm. So actually, we are looking for another China in early 1980s.
Right.
So in early 1980s, when the foreign investor coming to China and what they saw, there's no infrastructure, very poor people, and no purchasing power. And the first batch of foreign investor coming to China try to sell pants to Chinese people, and then they figure out that Chinese people are so poor they cannot buy pants. And then they hire Chinese people to produce pants and clothes. So I think maybe this is the advantage of a Chinese investor. So they are more practical. And then they can, it depends on which country they are investing. Probably for those countries who have rich resources and then have more large pool of labor and then relatively better education. And then they have the more or less the same system as China. And Chinese investor will have higher possibility to success. For example, like South Africa is one of the favorite places for Chinese investor, and also Southeast Asia.
Right.
Vietnam is one very good example. So we understand Vietnam much better than many foreigners, Westerners.
Yeah, understandably, that's true. I mean, China also, they don't come in with colonial legacy, the historical baggage.
Yeah, that's another advantage.
They might not be familiar with the regulatory landscape. They might not be particularly cosmopolitan in their outlook, but yeah, they have that going for them. And they do, as you were suggesting, the same thing that was done in China in the late 70s and the early 80s, mm-hmm, which is these infrastructure for resources deals, uh-huh, right? Very much like Japan did in China. Mm-hmm. And that's been their strategy in Africa. That's argued very forcefully by Deborah Brodigam in one of her books. It's quite good. Let's move back really quickly now to other sectors besides technology? We're all aware of a lot of the technology-focused investments. There's got to be a lot of going on in energy. I mean, we've seen China, as I said, blocked from some LNG deals in the U.S. What are China's big energy plays? One, you mentioned earlier that China is not going to invest in North Korea. Well, it might not be able to invest in Iran soon either, because Secretary Pompeo, as we saw the other day, he just basically announced that the United States was not going to tolerate any countries buying oil from Iran, with a very, very few exceptions. Those exceptions do not notably include China. China is, you know, it has imported up to 17% of its imported oil from Iran in years past. What does this foreclose investment opportunities in that part?
I think that challenge is not only to China, but also to the whole Europe. Europe has shared the same idea with Russia and China with only Iran issues, because you cannot just American dominating all the trade and the Iran. Now the American policy to Iran is not really agreed by the European and China. But I think I don't think there will be new Iranian war there. So I would think people will go through that. We don't know the result, but just a guess. If really we cannot get the oil from the Iran, and all the trade with Iran will be stop. I think it will be very. It's a very good. It's a very bad challenge to the Chinese.
I think for a last topic here before we wind up, I want to talk a little bit about China's immediate neighborhood in Northeast Asia, specifically Japan, and maybe also we talk about South Korea a bit. As I've said many times on this show, just sort of, you know, patting myself on the back, I remember thinking more than a year ago, we should expect to see a warming between Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe because of what was happening with Trump and steel and aluminum tariffs, with Beijing and Tokyo both interested in finding other potential trade partners. When Zhou Yaoba, September 18th, the anniversary of the Mukden incident in 1931, which marked the beginning of Japanese aggression in what was then Manchuria, when that anniversary passed in China, almost completely unremarked on in Chinese media, I suddenly said, aha, I see what's happening here. And it turns out I was right. We're seeing very interesting things happening right now between China and Japan. Very little rancor, less than I've seen in any year since 2012. So is there commensurate investment now going on? Japan is a very closed society. It's very closed off, I know, to a lot of foreign investment. But is Japan becoming a growing destination? You said for emigration, Michael. So in accordance with your theory, are we going to see investment there in something outside of the real estate sector?
I think that China and China-Japan, the relationship really dominates by the changing of the Sino-American relationship. About decoupling, even my friend He Fan say it's not decoupling now, but I say it's a trend of decoupling. Chinese are very pragmatic about everything, right? So even there is a trend, we should prepare very in the early stage. Like when we heard the news about China and the U.S. were decoupling for the trade war thing, and for most of other nations will be like the first five stage of the grave, right? The first the deny, then anger, then the last stage is the acceptance. But for the Chinese, it's different. It's like first it deny. Of course, we don't trust China-U.S. will be decoupling. But as long as you know that, they accept very quickly, almost like stage two or stage
four. I think we're in the stage of bargaining right now.
Yeah, but bargaining will be the stage five. That means I accept first and then bargaining. During the bargaining, this calculation, the Chinese calculate if China, in the future, if the American want to decoupling, the vacuum, what kind of thing will fill the vacuum? So you definitely will go to Europe, Japan, Korean, and ASEAN countries. That's the reason, the trigger, the rising of the Sino-Japan relationship.
Okay, He Fan.
I think if we put ourselves in Japan's shoes, and then we can understand you know, it's also a change of the attitude from Japan's side toward China. Because if you are Japan and then you feel reluctant to follow China, but then you feel more frustrated whether you should follow United States or not.
Right.
So the better way is to diversify your portfolio. So I think this improvement of the bilateral relationship between China and Japan as a strategy to diversify their portfolio, to avoid the potential risk. And whether there will be still a larger potential to increase either investment or trade between China and Japan, I doubt. Because now if you see the trade volume, and Japan accounts for less than 6% of China's export, and for South Korea, something like 4.4%. But then underneath this number is a regional production network which already existed.
Right, so supply chain.
Yeah, the supply chain, and then Japanese investment in mainland China, South Korea, company operating in China. So it's already linked with each other. I think there is no place that China can, you know, can close the gap if there's really decoupling between China and the United States. But then maybe a new area, a new market, and China will increase their investment and the trade in the near future. My guess is probably Southeast Asia. I heard quite a lot of Chinese companies moving to Southeast Asia. Because
it's absolutely happening. Yeah,
yeah, and because they have very successful business story in China. And then imagine that the size of China. And then if you can be success in China and then you move to other Southeast Asia, it's like you are moving from China to one province of China. So that's the reason why they feel more comfortable and confident in those markets.
I think Vietnam has about the population of our home province, Henan, right? Uh-huh.
But I see the difference. It's most, you can see the cell phone industry. Actually, cell phone industry, they're moving to two parts of the world. First, India. Second is Africa. Why Africa and India, not other countries? Because of the single market. China is successful of the internet industry because so many people, 1.4 billion people speak Mandarin, right? So if everyone uses the internet, so create one single market, internet market, really create the revenue. They move to the best choice, America, but America refuse you. The second choice will be India and English-speaking and French-speaking Africa. So you can, on that kind of part of the, you can find the single market with so many population in one internet.
What That's, about Indonesia?
But these in Muslim countries have not of a ban about, you know, it's not really the secular. So especially about financial rules, is very different.
India hardly is either, but
yeah. So that why Xiaomi and also the Chinese Shenzhen company dominated the American Africa.
Well, that's hardware. It's different. It's hardware. I mean, it is. It's a different thing. Anyway, so I mean, I think that we'll wind up with this question, which is you mentioned this gap that you know, in the advent of actual pursuit of decoupling would be there. You know, there's been an awful lot of hurt that China's experienced just in the last couple of years from the trade war. Could China make up this gap with increases in outbound investment or increased exports to the rest of the world? I mean, because look, I mean, the United States is a ferociously important market for China. It always has been. It has, nobody consumes like the American, right?
Yeah. American is the best buyer in the whole world.
Yeah, I know. I'm part of that. My weekend trips to Costco, $350, $400 every goddamn
time. So trip. That's the reason people in China prepare for the worst scenario of the Sino-American relationship. But still, people hope. We have no bad thing happened. We're still American buy Chinese goods.
Well, let's hope that Robert Lighthizer and Company and Liu He come up with something good. I think there are a lot of indications right now that we're going to see some substantive agreement. Most of the people who I'm talking to, these are former USTR people, are very, very optimistic about where things are heading. I hope that we all are too. Michael and Hofan, it's so great to speak to you, and I hope that we can have both of you back again on the show soon. Let's move to the recommendations segment of the show before we conclude, and I'll leave some time for audience questions at the end, although we won't be recording those. Michael, why don't you start with recommendations?
Yeah, I really love two American TV series. I think they represent...
We're supposed to be talking about not America. Oh, yeah, no, it's okay. But
I think the first thing is Billions.
Billions.
But also, like, Good Fight is about, you know, Good Fight.
Oh, The Good Fight.
Yeah, it's like The Good Wife,
Oh, no, I don't know that show.
Yeah, you should watch. I think The Billions, the new season of Billions, really represent the new scenario about, especially now, the president of America. That means, you know,
Trump,
there's no
America.
Good guy. There's no good guy. Even, you know, government is bad guy. So that really is, it's like people just pissed off everything, tired of the previous, you know, scenario about good guy really be sacrificed and bad guy always win. But now the new episode said everyone is bad. I think I'm also very sad when I watch the TV series. Why I watch this kind of TV series, I feel exciting. That means something in my mind also changed. I'm not good now. But also Good Fight, I think it's almost like carnival of the liberal people. They really, you know, represent almost every news you heard from American you know, politics, you can see the present in the TV series. I recommend you to watch.
Yeah, sort of like Veep.
Veep is too much away from the reality.
Oh, no, I just love that show.
Good Fight is very reality-based.
Cannot recommend that show more highly. That should be one of my recommendations. I'll mention in a second. But okay, great. So Billions and The Good Fight. All right. Hofan, what do you have to recommend for us?
Can I recommend my own book?
We'll make an exception. You've been such a good guest.
Two recommendations. One is my own book, my new book. The Chinese title is Bian Liang. And I would to translate it into English as Momentum. So it's a sort of a non-fiction documentation of what is happening in China. And this is the first book of my 30 books. I will write one book every year and in the coming 30 years to
you heard it here.
Yeah, so this is my first recommendation. So my second, I would like to recommend a French book. The English title will be sort of American Trap. It's a story told by a former manager of Alstom who was put in jail. And it's similar like what is happening as the Huawei episode. And I can tell you that this book will become a bestseller in China. So it will be interesting to see what Chinese reader, after reading the book, what will be their thinking,
Has to secure the rights for this book then quickly. And you know, that's his prediction, is it's going to be a bestseller. That would be great. Okay, I'll do two books then. One, just because we were talking about The Good Fight and I mentioned Veep. I read and managed two books on the plane on my 30-hour journey from North Carolina to here in the last couple of days. The first was, it's called Women First, First Woman. And it's a fake memoir written by Selina Meyer, who is, of course, played by Julie Louis-Dreyfus on the show Veep. It's hysterical because it's you know, recorded as an audiobook. I listened to it in an audiobook, and you know, she just does all these asides, like, you know, cursing her head off, and her aide Gary is in the booth with her, that obsequious toady, and it's just the funniest book. I cracked up. The other again, very light reading, Trevor Noah reading his own book, which is called Born a Crime, about his childhood growing up in Soweto and other parts of South Africa. The guy is brilliant and just funny and insightful and deep, and it's a fantastically interesting story. Highly recommend it. Born a Crime by Trevor Noah, who is, of course, the host of The Daily Show, which is required viewing for any good American also. Anyway, thank you very much once again for both of you and for all of you here. Let's hear it for our two fantastic guests, Michael Ante and Hofan. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason MacRonald. Special thanks this week to Li Xin and to all the good folks here at Caixin who made this episode possible. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the fantastic Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China New Voices, China Econ Talk, Ta for Ta, and the new Middle Earth podcast on the culture industry in China. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.